that sounding good to me? And you can hear me okay, clearly?
Yes.
Yeah, great. And okay, well, first of all, congratulations on the book, which I read last night at speed, but it's fantastic. I mean, as you say, it must have felt a slightly terrifying undertaking, but it brings the book alive in a new way. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, what I thought we'd do is speak. So I host a program called Weekend Arts, and we'll play it as part of that program. And the show is usually, the interviews are usually live. So we'll record it as live, but we've got that luxury that if I fall off my chair or you suddenly rush to the exit, we can edit it and make it sound like everything is seamless. So you've got that option. And I thought just that we'd begin by maybe talking about the novel first and then talking about your book. So, you know, we'll see how the conversation takes us, but that's just the way I've imagined it in my head.
Sure, okay.
And is there anything you want to check or say first off, or you're right?
No, I want to be responsive to your ideas, so... you know, it's easier for me, I think, to respond to you than, because if I start speaking about it, I'll start lecturing.
Well, I'm frightened the same thing, Benny. I started, you know, making notes, and then I realized, like, without even blinking, I can have 6 pages on Philip Roth. How is this possible in my just lurking there beneath my head? This is not, anyway, so... Maybe the listeners will be able to... I'm conscious of trying to think, okay, not everybody who's hearing this is going to know that Philip Roth is the greatest living writer, and secondly, that, you know, this quote from the Indignation Chinese National Anthem also appears in the novel Indignation. You know, like there is... I have to work on not being too too much of a Roth nerd, I think, but that's for me to deal with rather than you. So, and I should ask, Bernie, how do you want yourself described when I do the proper introduction on air? Your day job is political economist, is that right?
Yes. I think you might mention that I'm, I don't know how you want to position me exactly, because I have a fairly eclectic career. I'm a visiting professor of government at Dartmouth and an adjunct professor of business at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. I split my time between the two, and I'm probably best known as a political economist covering the Middle East conflict. But I've been a longtime friend of Roth and a great student of his work. And I undertook this to... really pay tribute to my friend, who I think is a great writer, and to a book that I think changed a lot of lives, including my own. So that's, you know, if you can kind of work with that, I think that's how much of that can work with.
That's definitely material that I can work with. So, Bernard, let's start with Portnoy's Complaint itself. I mean, as there will be people listening who don't get why they should start laughing when you mention Alex and Liver in the same sentence. So for those listeners, just give us a sketch of what this novel is.
Well, you're starting with sort of the most outrageous moment in it, since the book... in part exposes the masturbatory fantasies and practices of teenage life. Sort of high moment of comedy in that part of the book is when Alex goes to the butcher shop and picks up liver for dinner and winds up masturbating in the liver because it's the closest thing to flesh, I suppose, 13-year-old boy can come up with.
He does try an apple core at another part of the novel, but maybe the liver is more successful.
The apple core, I think, was a little more creative. But I think the main problem was being able to fantasize, as he says, some woman hungry for big boy who will give him what no other man has ever given her. I think that's the key. It almost doesn't matter what the aperture is.
And then, of course, the kind of the place that only Roth could take this comic monument is that I think it's at, what is it, like at 4:30, Alex Portnoy is masturbating into the liver, and at 6:30 he's sitting down to eat it at dinner with his family.
Right. And he, as he says, in great shame, since he, as he says, he's the Raskolnikov of jerking off, he says that he felt the shame of having fucked his family's dinner, which is, you know, again, it's really one of the high comic moments of the book. But in order to really appreciate the comedy, you have to understand that all of this is a psychoanalytic confession.
Mm. Mm.
A lot of people who read the book simply assume that this was a confession in the form of a novel. Actually, it was a novel in the form of a confession. The brilliance of the book, the genius of the book, is the way he put together a plausible psychoanalytic confession by a man, certainly no longer a teenager, but a young, vital man of 30, 35, who is on a psychiatrist's couch and remembering all these masturbatory fantasies in the context of trying to kind of understand his own neurosis.
And like any good psychoanalytic relationship, there are certain themes that come to the fore. And the one of masturbation or jerking off or any other number of slang terms that you can possibly think of, because pretty much all of them are in Portnoy's complaint, that takes up sort of is the energy of the first half of the book in a way, and obviously it's played for comedy. I mean, it's just impossible to hear you sort of say some of this stuff without laughing. And as you say in the book, it's even more strongly the sort of cumulative effect of these kind of outrageous activities this young Alex Portnoy gets up to. But it's not just about comedy. The stuff with masturbation, and this is that Alex Portnoy is kind of outlining to the psychiatrist, is this thing about freedom, about power. I think he says something that, you know, Dr. Mai Wang was all I really had that I could call my own.
Right, which is, again, a kind of invitation to talk about another comic moment of the book when he's masturbating and his mother is sort of knocking at the door and insisting, Alex, don't flush. I want to see what eating hamburgers has done to you. And you have this wonderful friction, this implicit
no
friction
pun
between
intended.
The incipient freedom of a young man whose sexuality and eros is a part of the development of his autonomy on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have the mother at the door describing his poopy because she hasn't quite come to terms with his incipient maturity. And he is finding the elements of his freedom within the context of a relationship with a mother who is kind of a typical folkloric Jewish mother concerned to improve her children, care about their welfare, and so on. And so you have, because in the background you have this sort of Freudian notion of development, which any reader of Portnoy's Complaint in a way has to have to fully appreciate the satire. You have this sort of Jewish mother as the quintessential superego figure repressing the development of the id. And, you know, as he says, he's trying to put the id in yid. That's the kind of big running joke in the beginning.
Yeah, this Sophie Portnoy, the mother figure, has become, as you suggest, this sort of shorthand for this this unbelievably overbearing Jewish mother who, though she has this perfect son in terms of his school performance, in terms of his behavior, is suggesting that at any minute his any transgression is so kind of unacceptable that he might have to leave home, you know, that it's so
that's right, he's publicly pleasing my parents while privately pulling my putts, as you say.
As you say, perhaps the most perfect alliteration in the English language. This is true.
Yes.
And the relationship, and so that, you know, and I think you point out in the book that Roth drew a lot of this from material that he was actually getting from creative writing students at his Iowa writing workshop when he was teaching
right.
there. This kind of
right.
the the mythic type of this very overbearing, controlling, anxiety-inducing mother and this kind of anxious, terrified, put-upon father who, in Portnoy's complaint, is constantly constipated and headaches that may any moment turn into a tumour. These are the sort of two poles that this young Alex Portnoy is attempting to negotiate his incipient masculinity between.
Right, which is a perfect reversal of the classical Freudian template, of course. That is, you have in the classical sort of Oedipus drama, a strong father, a mother who the boy wants to possess and the father won't let him, and the development of autonomy is within that realm of freedom that the child develops in identifying with the father, having been frustrated in the appropriation of the mother, identifies with the father, and then goes out and finds a woman of his own. That's sort of the healthy, quote-unquote, healthy way of developing. In this situation, if you understand the Freudian template, you understand that the totem and taboo are reversed, that the totem here is the mother. The weakness is in the father, and the great danger is not Oedipal tension but Oedipal victory, that you have the son appropriating the mother and therefore responsible for the mother's pleasure, responsible for the mother's satisfaction, which is a terrifying thing for a young man, creates a kind of narcissistic response, and that's why the boy become a man is lying on a psychiatrist's couch trying to figure out why he cannot connect to any woman. And Portnoy's complaint in that sense is understood to be a neurotic type. The psychiatrist of the piece, Dr. Spielvogel, is actually credited with having written an article called The Puzzled Penis, in which Portnoy is become a case, and the case is of a peculiar kind of narcissism where a boy can't achieve intimacy, can't achieve affectionate relations with a woman, and is lying on the couch trying so hard to figure out why, and it's this folkloric Jewish mother that's sort of getting in the way. By the way, it's not just that Roth was at the Iowa Writers' Workshop listening to all these Jewish boys talking about this folkloric mother and father, and a curious way, and not coincidentally, Roth was just finishing an analysis with a Dr. Kleinschmidt in New York, who, very much like Dr. Spielvogel, was trying to tell Roth that his art is a result of his narcissism, and his narcissism is the result of his having had a mother and father like this. And he kept saying, no, that you don't know my mother. My mother was so comme il faut. She wasn't like this at all. My father was actually a very strong man. You don't understand. And the doctor kept pressing this family on him. And finally, as he said to me, he was wrong about my family, but in a way he gave me a family that was more interesting than the one I had. It was a family I could use. And in some way, Kleinschmidt gave me Portnoy's complaint that I had this opportunity. And I said, you know what? You want this Jewish family? Okay, I'll give it to you.
Give it to you in spades.
This is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I guess this is something you tease out in your book, Promiscuous, is as you've said, Portnoy's complaint, the sort of conceit is that it's set up as Alex Portnoy in a psychiatrist's office with the sort of first-person narratives of psychoanalysis. And it's a perfect vehicle because it's about every kind of outrage or indignity or desire or fantasy. Like, nothing is too extreme, nothing is too petty. That is the understood, and at the time was in popular American culture at least, enough people got that that's what was meant to happen inside the confines of the psychiatrist's office for that to be a kind of believable narrative. You make a really interesting contrast in the book between Portnoy's first-person stories and Ulysses, Leopold Bloom in James Joyce's Ulysses, which is trying to get a man thinking. Well, what Roth is getting is a man speaking and speaking to a psychiatrist, which is a particular kind of language.
That's right. It's a kind of free association where nothing is really free. You see, the whole beauty of the narrative is that you start with pain, you burrow into dirt, you get to memory, you end with motive. You know, there's this sense that psychiatric confession is a series of linked perceptions. And when you actually do, you stand back and do an analysis of Portnoy in analysis, you realize that the associations are brilliantly conceived. One thing really follows from the other, a little like a Bruckner symphony. You know, you see the themes evolving, and you get this delightful and delightfully plausible psychoanalytic confession. Mm-hmm. The thing that you don't get, because it's a psychoanalytic confession, which is also, I think, a brilliant conceit, is that you don't get a moral stance as a reader. You don't get a place to stand. You don't get a place where you can say, oh, I see what I'm supposed to conclude from this. I have, say, a narrator. I mean, even in Ulysses, you have a third-person narrator at critical moments describing the inner life of character. And that third-person narrator tends to give you a sense of place. It encourages you to believe that if a third person can overhear and reproduce another person's consciousness, that third person will be morally reliable. That anybody who can figure out what another human being thinks that well will himself be morally reliable. Well, you have no place of moral reliability listening to Portnoy's complaint because the whole expression of perception is merely a kind of eavesdropping, and you don't really know where you're supposed to stand.
And this is one of the really interesting things going back to read Portnoy's complaint for me was, I mean, I think this is one of the delights of being a Philip Roth reader, is how those books intersect and how they echo and how the obsessions that are teased out in one book get played in a slightly different tune in another book.
Right.
And I mean, this one of those reoccurring obsessions in his fiction and in his autobiographical writing and his essays is where is this singular self? It doesn't exist. It's a sort of a set of competing arguments, some done in pleasure and kind of bravado and some in agony and torture, but they're all there. And in a way, this the conceit, as you put it, of the psychiatrist's couch allows those different selves to sort of, for the first time in his fiction, really explode out and start battling one another or
right.
jostling with one another for sort of believability or attention. And one of the things that was really an interesting thing to get from Promiscuous, I had not been aware at all of the counter story, to use a Roth term, or the counter life that was happening where Roth's own psychiatrist was using parts of the memories that appear as fiction in Portnoy's complaint, part of them that Roth must have told his psychiatrist being used as case studies in sort of psychiatric journals.
Right.
But I'll get you to talk about that, but as a reader, the wonderful thing is like how Roth uses them so much better, like that they're reinvented for kind of comic outrageousness and as part of this extraordinary creative work. Like it's like the novelist beats the psychiatrist in a way in what happens with his book.
Right. Well, in a way, the first thing Roth is saying is the psychiatric template is a kind of fiction. It's a work of fiction. And the psychiatrist was, you know, essaying a fiction the same way we all do when we're trying to understand other people. All we have are fictions. All we can do is construct these fictions of one another. And psychiatrists do it, or at least orthodox psychiatrists do it, orthodox psychiatrists like Spielvogel or Kleinschmidt in real life. All they have is fiction, but as he was implying, in order to do fiction well, you have to first admit that you're doing it at all. And, and he was terribly frustrated because Kleinschmidt actually took a number of the vignettes reproduced in Portnoy's complaint and used them as evidence in a psychoanalytic journal, in an article he wrote for a psychoanalytic journal on narcissism. It was pretty clear from the journal article what Kleinschmidt really felt about his patient, i.e. Roth.
Though who he disguises as a Southern playwright in his 40s.
As a Southern playwright in his 40s, right.
How cunning.
Which actually gets some things wrong. I won't go into it, but by disguising it in that way, he actually distorts the story in a way that in some sense falsifies the reality of the experience. But what's so interesting, given what you said, Sarah, is, you know, Roth then used that psychoanalytic article in that psychoanalytic journal as material for a standoff he had with another fictional encounter with Spielvogel in My Life as a Man, a subsequent novel of Roth's, where you get a strong understanding of what it felt like to read about this journal article after having confessed these things to a psychiatrist. So nothing is lost in Roth's experience. He reworked it in My Life as a Man yet again. Yeah. Then also the sexual obsessions he reworked in Sabbath Theater, which I tend to think, like Harold Bloom thinks, that, you know, that was just Portnoy's complaint in a tragic mode. It's the same.
Yes.
It's the same analysis of sexual obsession and the frustrations of sexual insatiability and the dangers of sexual insatiability, but in a tragic mode and not in a high comic mode, as you have in Portnoy's complaint.
Yeah,
so Philip does these endless riffs on these same things, but it always will come back to the idea that all we have are these fictions. We're constantly creating these fictions in order to understand ourselves and other people. And we cannot avoid, in a way, distorting the reality and trying to grasp it.
There's so much to say in response to that. I guess the first thing was, I don't know, the thing that strikes me initially when reading your book and reading this, how Roth's own psychiatrist used part of anecdotes told in his therapy in an academic paper was, I mean, the impression the outside world has of Philip Roth is an immensely private figure who is constantly saying, I am not Portnoy, I am not Sabbath, I'm not Zuckerman. Of course, and then writes books like The Facts that play with our desires as readers to pin these reoccurring Jewish narrators down to being someone like Philip Roth. But was he willing? I mean, you obviously worked with him to a degree on the book. You know, a lot of your conversations are included there. The fact of your relationship, your friendship that's gone on for decades is part of the climate of the book. Was he willing for that? Was that crossing it struck me as surely that's crossing a privacy boundary that Philip Roth isn't supposed to want crossed.
Oh, boy, you're raising a sort of sensitive issue. First of all, Philip was extremely generous with his time and his friendship as I wrote this book. We spoke, I think I have 6 hours of taped interviews, let alone, you know, so many conversations we had over the years. You know, you say, and of course it's true, Philip isn't Alex, but he's also Alex. That's part of his charm. I mean, every conversation, Alex is sort of seeping out. You know, I'll be in his apartment going to the bathroom and he'll knock on the door and say, Bernie, what are you doing in there? You know, I mean, that's Philip. That's the joy of all the different persona that come out in his fiction, also come out in his friendship. He's a terrifically funny companion. You're right in the sense that I had one great anxiety in producing this book, which is that I would betray in some way some detail, some confidence, something that he had shared with me over the years, and I think we have literally no secrets, and that somehow that would get into print and he would be concerned, he would be upset and be, and our friendship would in any way suffer from it. That really bugged me. Mm. The first draft of the book, I say so in the acknowledgments, I don't know if you caught that, but I said in the acknowledgments that I used a great deal of the informal taped conversation in the original draft. And Philip got in touch with me last February, well, actually 2 years ago, February, and said, you know, Bernie, take that out. I don't want to be there in my own voice. But it wasn't so much because he was concerned about giving up detail or revealing something that's private. He was concerned as a writer that the undercooked articulations, formulations, narratives that he shared with me on tape would become, as it were, definitive, and that he would not have a chance to work them. You know, if he's going to go public about what he thought about Portnoy's or what happened in his psychiatric sessions or whatever, he wanted a chance to work them in a way that would be true to his sense of the way things were, and that they would not come out as sort of undigested, unfinished thoughts.
They have to be in the dazzling Roth prose.
Exactly. And he said, you know, take me out. At first, I was a little hysterical, and until we kind of worked out what he meant by that so that I could use materials around which, after all, much of my book is constructed, it took a little bit of negotiation. In the end, actually, it worked out well because, you know, when you have a Roth interview that can intervene in the middle of something you're writing, you actually don't have to write as succinctly or as precisely as you might otherwise do, because you can always get, you know, throw in some interview material and then the reader will be happy with that and forget that you didn't quite make your point before. When I took out that interview material, I actually found myself rewriting in a much more precise and sustained way. So he did me a favor, and he very much liked the result, and I was greatly relieved by that.
So I wonder, Bernie, why out of all of Roth's books you chose to focus on Portnoy's Complaint?
I suppose because it changed my life, because it was such a pivot for me. I felt after I read Portnoy's Complaint, I felt like I had been outed, I was forced out of the closet, you know. There's a way in which we all read the book and thought, here is the rest of me, you know. Thank you, here is the rest of me. And you didn't have to be Jewish to feel that way. I mean, another very close friend of mine, Jim Carroll, who's a former Catholic priest, felt exactly the same way.
The Catholics have got a lot of the same problems, though, Bernie. That's not a fair comparison. You know, you need to cast a wider net to be convincing.
I'll go to Nelson Aldridge, who's sort of a high wasp.
That's what we need. Yeah.
And he had exactly the same feeling. I mean, I'm sure if you go to the Khmer Rouge or the Taliban, you'd find people with the same complaint. Because after all, what he's talking about is this universal sense that our eros is the fuel of our ambition, and there's always a danger that we blow ourselves up in our own fuel. That's the beauty of the book. And for me, at the age of 20, 69, yes, so I was the age of 20, reading this book before I knew Philip, of course, I felt that he had exposed to myself a version of myself which was incipient, but which I had not found the words for. It was like he brought was from what was in the back of my mind to the tip of my tongue. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of people felt that. A lot of young people, not just Jewish people, felt that. In fact, I think that in a way, the fact that the complainant here was a Jew, a person who, given the way America was at the time, was a kind of poster child for bourgeois restraint, the person who, you know, like the Sharks are fighting the Jets, but there's like the Jewish candy store owner who's saying, why can't you just get along? You know, I mean, there's always sort of the Jew in popular culture who was able to control
yeah.
himself because of some combination of persecution and kashrut. You know, if you don't mix milk with meat, then obviously you know how to control your sexual desires. You know, that somehow the Jew, the quintessential bourgeois, the poster child for bourgeois restraint, if a Jew can't avoid these contradictions and erotic charges, then every man can't. That was the great triumph of the book. And in a way, it was also important for American Jews to have this moment when, you know, because they thought that they were endearing themselves by being, you know, so restrained, like, you know, being that soda fountain guy, you know, or the pawnbroker, you know, Mr. Nasaman, you teach me things, you know, Mr. Nasaman, you know, you teach me things. And it's sort of Nasaman who's able to kind of hold it all together morally. And, you know, Jews thought that the Nasamans of the world were the people who endeared Jews to the rest of America. And no, we discovered with Portnoy's complaint that it was actually secretly making Jews hateful to the rest of America. No, but as soon as Portnoy came out, everybody had this huge sense of relief. Oh, Jews are just like us. You know, fantastic. You know, finally Jews entered the American mainstream because they were like no better. And, you know, there was a wonderful moment. Philip taught Portnoy's complaint to a class at Bard, Bard College.
Yep.
And he shared his lecture notes with me. And at the bottom of his lecture notes, he wrote in his own hand, Jews are members of the human race. Worse about them, I cannot say.
It's like a line from Chekhov or something. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. It had the sort of diction. I mean, I don't speak Russian, but it has the diction of a Chekhov translation into English.
And I guess, like, I mean, as you draw out in the book Promiscuous, it part of the sensation of the novel at the time, and it was first published in 1969, was this extraordinarily iconoclastic work, partly because of, as you put it, Jews were the sort of poster boys and girls for upstanding moral self-control. But also, I mean, and it's unbelievably shocking, a bit like Sabbath Theatre. You know, when you read it, you kind of laugh, you know, your toes are curling and you're laughing out loud that he's actually saying some of this stuff. But, you know, there were sexually explicit shocking books before that, like Portnoy's Complaint, had been banned. I read that Portnoy's Complaint was originally banned in Australia. But what's different is, one of the things that's different is that it's funny and that it doesn't suggest some kind of like D.H. Lawrence-like wholeness that's available if only Alex Portnoy would, you know, meet the right shishka who would make all of his desires come true, that he could kind of live happily in New Mexico. Like, there's no sense that there will be some, although that's what he desperately wants, he knows that that's not going to be offered him, that this force of eros, of sexuality, of desire, of selfishness, of self-obsession is going to be the fuel for everything, but it's never going to get to resolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think Philip himself at the end of the novel gestures toward that, of course, because he takes Alex to Israel, where alienation is banned, you know, where Jews are supposed to be fully self-realizing. And he meets this soldierette and takes her to his room. And for the first time, he cannot perform sexually. And then he meets another young woman who reminds him of his mother, a woman named Naomi, this redhead and sort of dashing, poised American Jew walking around Israel, but very Zionist. And he's trying desperately to fall in love with her and can't. And she's accusing him of being full of self-doubt and self-mockery, and she can't stand it anymore. And she says, you know, you're nothing but a self-hating Jew. And he finally says to her, yes, and they're the best kind. And you have exactly this idea that you leave the novel with people who are wonderfully self-hating. That is to say, they cannot achieve resolution because in their self-criticism is the key to their genius.
Mm.
Their critical self-knowledge, their understanding that they can never fully understand themselves, their unwillingness to fall back on dogmas or consoling and reassuring psychoanalytic notions of health, of healthfulness.
And, of course, anyone who ever does that in a Roth novel is going to get undone, whether by history or by their children or – but, you know, that pastoral sense of the self, as Roth puts it, that
right.
idea of the self as some healthful, resolved state is undercut in every novel by something.
Right. And you know, one of the things I did quote of his conversations with me, which I refused to take out, and he was happy to let me leave it in, is when he says, you know, when you use phrases like illness and health, you're outside the precincts of this book.
Mm.
Health is not a useful fiction for Roth.
Mm.
It actually is a kind of dogma.
Much more useful.
And,
sorry,
go ahead.
Just much more useful is the mode of complaint. I think at one point Alex says, you know, is this, am I just engaging in this sort of self-obsessed kvetching, and excuse my Yiddish, but
right.
or is kvetching for people like me a form of truth? And
well, complaint is a kind of kick against your mortality. You know, complaint is a kick against conformity and convention. Now, complaint is not the same as knowledge or criticism, but it is a kind of opening to the kind of critical thinking. I mean, that's also such a terrible cliche,
well,
critical
but it's,
thinking.
It's a Murray-Reingoldian, a Murray-Reingoldism.
I'm open to. Isn't Reingold a beer?
What's Murray's surname in I Married a Communist? And isn't
Murray,
it
that's right.
But
Murray.
Is he Ryan Ringgold? Murray Ringgold.
Ringgold. Yeah.
Sorry.
That's right. I mean, it is all you've got. This capacity to complain. It's at least an opening to a critical stance with respect to all orthodoxy.
Mm.
And I think for Roth, if there's a political message in Portnoy's complaint, which I believe there is, in the end, it's a critique of all orthodoxy. It's the assumption that even the orthodoxies of bourgeois life, even the orthodoxies of the psychoanalytic couch are subject to being undermined. And And all we have, therefore, are these fictions that we can create about one another, which is a lot. In I Married a Communist, in the end, I end the book with this, but he, you know, Roth is thinking about what a miracle it is that we can somehow, in the middle of all these fictions we create about one another, listen to another's voice and even dimly perceive that voice with understanding. And that all we can do is continue to write these fictions, knowing again and again and again that we're going to fail to fully appreciate or fully understand the other. That's the sort of wonderful thing you're really left with. And that's why I think the fact that Portnoy's Complaint was written at the end of the 1960s is, in a way, as Marxists like to say, no accident. You know, I mean, it felt like at the end of the 60s, you needed a book to tell you, hey, you know, okay, we have the civil rights movement. We have the idea that we're going to be judged not by the color of our skin, but the content of our character. Well, you know something? The content of our character is actually not self-evident. And it's not going to be an easy job to figure out the content of anybody's character. And the freedom that we believe in and that are at the heart of our notion of civil rights is actually a kind of magical kind of faith. We believe in it, even though we know that ultimately the idea of understanding is a leap of faith. Mm. We will never fully understand another human being
or ourselves, in fact,
or ourselves, and certainly no orthodoxy will capture it. All we have is the capacity to criticize orthodoxy, and that will at least be the opening to some kind of sense of self.
Mm. I had the sense too, Bernie, from your book that it was important for you to go back to this book at this point in your life, that yes, it had this sort of revelatory power for you and a whole generation in 1969, but you can look at Alexander with a different kind of compassion almost a few decades on.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, as I said in the book, there are ways in which it's a little dangerous to, you know, even for one in his 60s, you know, as even for a Jew, you know, but even for one in his 60s, it's a little dangerous to go back and listen to Portnoy describing his infinite erotic fantasies. It's a little dangerous for any of us to go back and do that. But I suppose I've reached enough maturity so that overlayered with that little sort of pornographic clip that keeps playing again and again in the back of my mind, and I'm presuming in the back of every male's mind. I also have enough life experience to hear Portnoy and, instead of simply identifying with him, feel a little compassion for him, a little bad for him, at times sort of wanting to smack him, like, you know, hey, guy, you know, it's time to sort of stop comparing your life to its ideal and start comparing your life to the alternative, which is death. Mm. You know, if the alternative is death, somehow the bar gets lowered significantly and you don't feel you have to plank a wilderness of monkeys, you know. Like, for those people who don't know, the monkey is his nickname for his Gentile lover, who is sort of the focus of his erotic dreams for a long period of time in the book.
Who can kind of exist in the erotic place that Portnoy longs to and fantasizes about and articulates, but when he gets there, has a crisis of nerves or has to go and throw up in the bathroom, or, you know, like it's that duality that is there at the heart of every Roth fiction, is this set of conflicting impulses. On the one hand, to be that good son, and on the other hand, to go wild in a, you know, an Italian hotel room with a monkey and a hooker that they pick up on the street. But the reason it's a fiction and the reason it's kind of got an energy is because he can't. The inhibitions keep pulling him back.
Right. Well, he can, but then he'll regret it. But then there's also the issue of the monkey. The monkey, of course, cannot remain just a monkey. You know, she becomes enough of a woman to begin to create demands, to begin, she begins to desire something like a relationship. And once you have a relationship, you start to have demands that feel terribly suffocating to Portnoy. And, you know, he begins to unravel also because of his fear of what it means to have to deal with the woman and not just with her body parts. Mm. That's that, you know, but that is also a strong Roth theme. But again, that doesn't make Roth unique. There are lots and lots of writers who deal with that kind of thing. What keeps the book fresh for us, Portnoy fresh for us, is, as I said before, this psychoanalytic template that is a piece of his satire. Mm. He's satirizing also that, so that you come away from the book feeling like you've learned to suspect all orthodoxies, really.
What I wonder how Roth sees the book now in terms of the series of works he's written since. I mean, I know that at the time he talked about how it freed him from certain constraints, certain writerly constraints he had about, right, you know, clear, right, good, well-behaving narrative, and
right,
something,
right,
much looser and wilder that comes out in Sabbath Theatre or in a lot of his later novels.
Right. I think he actually said this at the launch party for the book in New York, that he saw the book really as a way of freeing himself as a writer. It was a very important book for him to write, not because he thinks it's the great legacy. It's not the book that he will want to be remembered for, and he doesn't think of it as his great book. I don't think he has a sense that he's written one great book. I think he wants to be thought a writer with an oeuvre, you know. But he did think of the book as a pivot for him, a moment when he freed himself. I actually disagree with that assessment. I think he will be remembered for Portnoy's Complaint.